We discussed a little bit. We're going to discuss at length. We have a whole series of lectures on this topic. We discussed briefly the Rambam's division of the Mishnayos, all of the contents of the Mishnah and the entire Torah Shebaal Peh is divided into five parts. The first part was what he calls Pirusha Mahamukubalim Lamoshe Misinai. And he gives the example of Priyetz Hadar and Ayin Tachasayin, that the Pasuk is not to be translated literally. We have a tradition that this is what that phrase means. The second part of the Torah Shebaal Peh is what the Rambam calls Halachas Lamoshe Misinai, that we have an oral tradition that this is the din, has no source from the Chumash, no way to derive this at all. Namely, that the tefillin have to be in a square shape, and that the ritzuas of the tefillin have to be black. And the Rambam gives you a list of, one short page, he gives you a list of what he considers are the halachas l'moshe misinai. He considers it a complete list, and we discussed that a little bit. And this is the second category, the second section of Torah Shebaal Peh, halachas l'moshe misinai. The third section, which is the bulk of the Torah Shebaal Peh, are all of the dinim that are derived through the midas shatar and the drashas ben. The rabbis had a method of reading in between the lines, and that's what we're going to have to dedicate a few lectures to that topic. Let's just try to finish a little bit the Rambam. The Rambam says he has a fourth and a fifth section of Torah Shebaal Peh. The fourth section is what he considers Gzeiras Derabbanan, and the fifth section is what he calls Takanas Derabbanan. The Rambam, those who may be familiar with the Rambam and his Sefer Mishneh Torah, the Rambam is fond of using an expression Divrei Torah as opposed to Divrei Sofrim. When the Rambam refers either to a Din Derabbanan or to a Din which is Min HaTorah, a biblical Din, but it's not Torah Shebichsav, it's only derived through the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Rambam will often refer to that as Divrei Sofrim. And this causes a lot of confusion by other people. Just to mention one instance, recently in the newspapers, there's this whole big hullabaloo about whether any of us who are married biblically or rabbinically, because under the chuppah, the chosen gives the ring to the kala, and this is, the Rambam writes that this is medivrei sofrim. The question is, what does that mean, medivrei sofrim? So there were those who misunderstood the Rambam in the 1500s, there were those who misunderstood the Rambam to think that he meant to say that kiddushei kesef is only the rabbanon. So Rabbi Yosef Karo, the same one who authored the Shulchan Aruch, wrote a commentary on the Rambam that's printed in all the standard editions of the Rambam. It's known as the Kesef Mishnah. So the Kesef Mishnah on the side of the Rambam quotes that misunderstanding, that Kiddushei Kesef is only the Rabbanah. And he straightens it out on the first page in the Rambam in Hilchas Ishus, and he explains that anyone who's familiar, slightly familiar with the expression, with the language of the Rambam, knows that the expression Divrei Sofrim in the Rambam is not necessarily reserved for Dinim Derabbanah. It applies to all of Torah Shebaal Peh, Dinim Derabbanan and Dinim Deraisa that are derived through the Midrash HaTorah and the Drashas Peh. And the Rambam is not the one who originated this terminology. He got it from the Talmud, from the Mishnayos and from the Braises. People who are familiar with Mishnayos will know that this is the Talmudic expression, except that we today write and speak a modern Hebrew, so we're not used to this. This is like speaking an archaic, an ancient Hebrew, but the Rambam wrote his Mishnah Torah in Talmudic, in Mishnaic Hebrew. So he uses the terminology that appears in the Mishnah. If people are interested in looking it up, we're going to discuss this a lot today. The Mishnah appears in one of the several sources where this expression appears, Divrei Sofrim as opposed to Divrei Torah, is the Mishnah in Sanhedrin on Daf Peches on the base, where the Mishnah speaks of the din of a Zokim Mamre. Zokim Mamre means a rabbi who paskins against the psak of the Bezen HaGodol. Years ago, every rabbi had the right to paskin however he wanted, unless the Bezen HaGodol, the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim, would have issued a psak, so then no one is permitted to paskin against them. So the Mishnah says there are two areas where the Bezen HaGodol may issue a psak and the rabbi, the Zokim Mamre, may paskin against them, the area of Divrei Torah or the area of Divrei Sofrim. So Divrei Torah, we would have thought, sounds like it's more serious than Divrei Sofrim. That's what we discussed last week. The Torah Shebaal Peh is considered, someone said, more authentic, so we changed the expression, not more authentic, but more serious and more chomer than Divrei Sofrim. So here the Mishnah writes, so here there's a, the din is just the reverse. The din is that the Zokim Mamre is only chayiv misa if he paskins against the psak of the Bezen HaGodol, only in the area of Divrei Sofrim. If he paskins against the Bezen HaGodol in the area of Divrei Sofrim, then he's not chayiv misa. Let's say the Bezen HaGodol paskins, you have to wear tefillin every day. The Zokim Mamre says only on Mondays and Thursdays. Or Rosh Chodesh, you don't have to wear tefillin, something like that. So the Mishnah says the Zalkamamri will not be Chayiv Misa, only if he paskins in an area of Torah Shebal Peh. That's called Divrei Sofer. So the Ram and the Mishnah is speaking about a Din Menator. The Mishnah is not speaking about a Din Medrabah. The Mishnah refers to it as Divrei Sofer. So the Rambam has this expression, Divrei Sofrim, which he uses to refer to all the entire area of Torah Shebal Peh, including both the Dinim Deraisa and the Dinim Derabanan, all of the five parts that he broke down in the introduction to the Pirush HaMishnayos, the five sections of the Torah Shebal Peh, he refers to all of this as Divrei Sofrim. There are two versions. If you look in the commentaries on the Sefer HaMitzvos, there are two versions as to exactly what the terminology means when it appears in the Rambam and in the Mishnah and the Talmud. Why do we call it Divrei Sofer? So some say, well, it was transmitted by the rabbis from generation to generation. That's why it's called Divrei Sofer. Divrei Torah is what's Torah Shebichzav, and Divrei Sofer is whatever's Torah Shebal Peh. And others, that's the standard commentaries on the Sefer HaMitzvahs, write like that. And others choose to say a little differently, a little sharper, maybe more correct, but you have to study all the sources to see if the idea is correct. That the Divrei Sofrim only refers to those parts of the Torah Shebal Peh where there was rabbinic input. Let's say the Pirushim HaMekubalim L'Moshe MiSinai, Ayin Tachasayin and Pri Eitz Hadar. Or the Halachas L'Moshe MiSinai, that the tefillin have to be square and the tefillin have to be black. There's absolutely no rabbinic input over there. That's just a tradition that was transmitted from generation to generation. So that's a question whether the Rambam would really refer to that as the Divrei Sofrim. So the standard commentaries on the Sefer HaMitzvahs think that, yes, they think that the phrase Divrei Sofrim includes all of Torah Shebal Peh. And others think that no, that Divrei Sofrim only means where there was rabbinic input, whether to introduce a Din Derabanan, that's Divrei Sofrim, or to formulate a Din Deraisa, that would be Natur. I'll call upon him. The Rambam includes these two, the fourth and the fifth categories of the sections in the five divisions of the Torah Shebal Peh. He includes the Gzeres Derabanan, and the Takanas Derabban. We'll discuss a little bit what's the difference. Now, the Mishnah that we mentioned earlier, just 2 minutes ago in Sanhedrin, says that the Zalkamamri is only Chayv Misa if he paskins against the Bezna Godel. So the Mishnah says it's only if he paskins in the area of Divrei Sofrim. If he paskins in the area of Divrei Torah, he's not Chayv Misa. The Talmud applies this principle in other areas as well. I didn't explain what the principle is. The principle is that psak, pyro, the paskin ashayla, is a technical term that only applies within the area of Torah Shebal Peh. You cannot have psak on Torah Shebichzav. Let's say somebody asks the rabbi, is he allowed to do malocha on Shabbos? And the rabbi says, no, you're not permitted to do malocha on Shabbos. They say, my rabbi paskin that you're not allowed to do malocha on Shabbos. My rabbi paskin that you have to put on tefillin. That's not called a psak. If you ask a shayla that's explicit in the Chumash, so the Talmudic expression for that is in Aramaic, zil, go, kri, beirav. Beirav means in the yeshiva. Go ask a child in the yeshiva where they teach Chumash, where they teach Tanakh. That's for the children to paskin that. Chumash is Chumash. That's not called a psak, and that's not called a hayroah. Hayroah and psak can be used interchangeably. Only applies in the area of Torah Shebal Peh. So this principle is developed by the Talmud in three different areas. At least in three different, maybe more, but three obvious areas. One is by the Zalkamamri. The Zalkamamri is not Chayv Misa if he doesn't listen to the Bezna Godel. Let's say the Bezna Godel paskins one way and he continues to go on his own merry way, he doesn't listen to them, he's not Chayv Misa. Only if he paskins in public against them. So that's why the Mishnah says that the concept of Psak and Hayro is limited only to Torah Shebal Peh. There's no such thing as Psak in Torah Shebichzav. So Memela, the Zalkamamri will never be Chayv Misa. And the Talmud has this principle in another two areas of halacha. Another is, there is an institution that's called Par Helam Davar Shel Tzibur. If the Bezna HaGodol paskins that something is mutter, different parts of the animal, different parts of the chelev of the animal are prohibited, and some of the fats of the animal are permissible. So you have to have a shayla. In Tosfos there already are disputes. Today there are still disputes regarding certain chalovim of the animal, how you have to trade with the flesh of the animal to remove which sections of the fat. So some of the fats are mutter, some of the fats are rotzah. So let's say the Bezna Godel paskins that a certain fat is mutter. The chief rabbi says mutter is mutter, so everybody eats it. After everybody's eating this for a year or two, then the chief rabbin at the Bezna Godel realizes they made a mistake and they were responsible for everybody violating this chelev. And they publicize everybody should stop eating this chelev. It's an avera derais. Or the Bezna Godel paskins, you're allowed to turn on lights on Shabbos. It's not included in the prohibition of havor. A lot of turn on lights, everybody listens. And then after a while, the Bez Nagadol changes their minds. They realize that they made a mistake, and they announce that no one should turn on lights. We made a mistake. We retract our decision. So if the Rov HaTzibur has violated this din, the din really should have been that whoever violates an Aveira B'Shoigig, which if he would have violated it B'Mezit, he would have been Chayv Kareis, of such an Aveira is violated B'Shoigig, one is obligated to bring a Karban Chatas. Let's say, if I talk Lashon Hara B'Shoigig, so I don't have to bring a Karban Chatas, because even if I would have spoken the Lashon Hara B'Mezit, you wouldn't be Chayv Kareis. So if you Gamva, if I cheat on income tax B'Shoigig, so you don't have to bring a Karban Chatas, because if I would cheat B'mezid, I wouldn't be chayv koris. But if you mechal Shabbos b'mezid, you are chayv koris. Or if you eat chayla b'mezid, you are chayv koris. If somebody's mechal Shabbos b'shoigig, if somebody eats chayla b'shoigig, then he's obligated to bring a korban chatas as a kaparis. Here, so many people ate chayla, and so many people turned on the lights on Shabbos, but it wasn't really their fault, it was the fault of the Bez Nagadol. So the din in the Talmud is the following. If miyut ha-tzibur, if less than 50% of the Jewish population living in Eretz Yisrael, those who live in Chutz Lortz are second-class citizens. The Talmud says only those who live in Eretz Yisrael, they're the Iker of Klal Yisrael. So if less than 50% of the Jewish population living in Eretz Yisrael violated the Aveira, even though it's not their fault. The Psak was given by the Bez Nagadol, then is each and every individual Jew and woman and Jewish has to bring his own Korban Chatas. But if more than 50% of the Jewish population living in Eretz Yisrael violated this Aveira, then the din is that the Bez Nagadol has to bring a special Korban Chatos. That's called a par. It's a big ox. A par helam dover shel tzibur. Helam dover means that the Bez Nagadol, something slipped their minds. They made a mistake. They paskin incorrectly. And when the Bez Nagadol brings this par helam dover shel tzibur, this special Korban Chatos, then the individual people who violated Aveir B'Shegig will be exempt from bringing their own chatas. They will all gain the kapara, they'll all gain atonement by the korban that's offered by the Bez Nagadol. So this din, that if the Bez Nagadol paskin in error, that they have to bring the special parhel of Novishal Tzibur, the Talmud says that it only applies if the mistake was in the area of Torah Shebal Peh. If the mistake was in the area of Torah Shebichsav, you live in a generation where nobody knows what it says in the Chumash, like in our generation. Nobody knows what it says in the Chumash. You get rabbis get up, the chief rabbi gets up, and he passes mutar to be mechal Shabbos. You don't have to keep Shabbos. And then later on, everybody listens to the chief rabbinate, they violate. And then later on, the chief rabbinate realizes they made a mistake. The Bez Nagadol realizes they made a mistake. So the din is there won't be any parhel and davar shel tzibur. If the mistake was made in Torah Shebichsav, so that's not called a psak, that's not called a hayro. Hayro only relates to Torah Shebal Peh. The third instance, each and every individual person has to bring his own private korban chatos. No, they violated it b'shoigeg. You don't have here b'shoigeg. You don't get the death penalty, that's for sure. But they bring a korban chatas. If it was in the area of Shabbos, in the area of Chelev, where if they would have violated it b'mezid, it would have been koreis. So now they violated b'shoigeg. So each and every individual person has to bring a korban chatas. We will not say, let the Bez Nagadol bring the one parhel and novishal team and everybody will have a kapora. The Bez Nagadol doesn't. They're at fault over here. They were the ones who gave the psak, but the psak al-pidin is not considered a psak hayro. In Psak only applies in the area of Torah Shebal Peh. In the third instance, where the Talmud has this explicitly, there may be more than three, but I'll just mention these three. The third area in Halacha is the following. It happens to be in the American Constitution. Also, there's a principle of double jeopardy, that if someone is up in the American Constitution, it's a little distorted from the way it appears in the Talmud, but the way it appears in the Mishnah is the following. If someone is up on a case where the Bezin is judging whether he's Chayiv Misa or Malkus. It doesn't apply to Dinim Amnes. If the discussion is whether the person violated an Aver for which he deserves the punishment of the death penalty or Malkus, so let's say the Bezin discusses the case and then they decide that he's Pata. He's not guilty. He's innocent. And then later on, the next day, they realize they made a mistake. They really made a mistake. The din is that he's really Chayiv Misa, they really Chayiv Malkus. So that's what we call in American Constitution double jeopardy. In Halacha, it's called Yotzemi Bezin Zakai. This is one of the 10 differences. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin lists off the 10 differences between judging a case of Dinim Amnes as opposed to judging a case of Dinim Nefashis. So in Dinim Nefashis, this is one of the principles, that once the person is Yotzemi Bezin Zakai, once the Bezin, even though they made a mistake, the Bezin says that they made a mistake, if the Psak was that he's Potter, So then they have no right to bring him back and be mechayiv him misa. In Dini Mominis, the rule does not apply. In American law, it applies even to Dini Mominis. And the Mishnah says explicitly that it only applies to Dini Nefashis. So the Talmud explains in the Gemara Sanhedrin that this principle of Yotza Mibezen Zaka, if Bezen gave a psak, that the fellow is potter from Misa or Malkus, that they cannot judge him a second time to give him the death penalty, only applies if the mistake in psak was in the area of Torah Shabalpeh. If the mistake was in the area of Torah Shabichsav, that's not called a psak. A psak in Torah Shabichsav doesn't exist. Psak only, hoiro, only applies in the area of Torah Shabalpeh. In fact, the Rambam's opinion seems to be that this is what smicha is all about. What's the difference between a person who does have smicha and a person who doesn't have smicha? I think we mentioned last week that today in our generation nobody really has any real smicha. All of our smicha is only imitation smicha. Because smicha has to be conferred in Eretz Yisrael. And for many generations we have not been getting any smicha in Eretz Yisrael. It has to be, you have to give the smicha, the one who's conferring the smicha has to be one who himself got smicha from someone in Eretz Yisrael or got smicha from someone else who got smicha in Eretz Yisrael, all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So already in the days of the Amoroim, all the rabbis in Bavel, all the Amoroim in Bavel, none of them had any smicha. That's why they're not called the Rebbe. They're called Rab Nachman. Like today you have a rabbi and you have a reverend. So in the Talmud you have like that. The Chachomim in Eretz Yisrael, who did have smicha, were called Rebbe. There's Rebbe Avino, and Rebbe Yassi, and Rebbe Yassi, and Rebbe Yochanan, and Rebbe Ami, Rebbe. Rebbe means he really had smicha because they lived in Eretz Yisrael. They got smicha from someone else. They got smicha from who got smicha from someone else. They got smicha in Eretz Yisrael all the way back till Yeshua ben Nun, who had gotten his smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu. Whereas the Chachamim who lived in Bavel, it wasn't like today. You take a plane and you fly to Eretz Yisrael. You learn the yeshiva, you get smicha, you come back. It wasn't so easy to go fly to Eretz Yisrael. So those who were born and lived in Eretz Yisrael never got any smicha. So they're called Rav Nachman and Rav Ashi, Reverend. They're not called Rabbi because they didn't have any smicha. So is there a difference in halacha whether the person has smicha or not? You have in our generation many stockbrokers that don't have any smicha. They know how to learn better than many rabbis who do have smicha. So what's the difference in the days of the Talmud, whether the person does have smicha, doesn't have smicha? So the difference is exactly this. The Mishnah says in Sanhedrin that the Zochem Mamri, who paskins against the Bez Magodl, is only chayv misa if he's a chochem shehigia lo hayro. If he's only a Talmud and he paskins against the Bez Magodl, then he's not chayv misa. He's a bigger chutzpah. A Talmud who doesn't have a Talmud who's lo higia lo hayro, he's not entitled to an opinion either. He has the chutzpah to disagree with the Bez Magodl. One would have thought that it's a bigger averis, and the Mishnah says, yeah, it is a bigger averis. Nimtza chumro kulo, because he did a bigger averis, so that's where he gets off. He doesn't get the punishment of the death penalty. He's only chayv misa if he's a zokem mamre, one who had smicha, who paskins against the Bez Nagodl. So the Rambam learns pshat in this Mishnah in the end of Sanhedrin, that what's called, how do you define a chacham shehigia lohayro, as opposed to a Talmud? A Talmud means one who doesn't have smicha, and a chacham shehigia lohayro means one who does have smicha. So smicha, if one has smicha and the issue is an opinion, that's called a psak, provided that it's in the area of Torah Shebal Peh. In the area of Torah Shebichsav, there's no hayro, and in the area of Torah Shebal Peh, there's only hayro, if the psak is given by one who has smicha. Today, nobody has any smicha, because the whole institution of smicha has been lost 1,500 years ago, over 1,500 years ago, and our smicha is an imitation smicha, it's a different principle. So therefore, nobody has any psak today. There's no hayro, there's no psak. We just use these expressions as a losh and mushal. So getting back again, the Rambam, this Rambam is very fascinating. We're going to discuss all the things that we mentioned now. We're going to be discussing more at length in later talks. So the Rambam is describing the five sections of the Torah Shebal Peh, and the last two, section 4, section 5, includes all of the dinim derabbanan. We're going to explain what's a gzera, what's a takana. It includes two different categories of dinim derabbanan. That's very interesting. The Rambam, and this is all called Divrei Sofer. Divrei Sofer includes Dinim Derabbanan and Dinim Derais, or whatever is Torah Shebal Peh. The Rambam includes this in the Torah Shebal Peh. All the Dinim Derabbanan are included in the Torah Shebal Peh. That's very interesting. When I come here by train, and I get out of the train on 79th Street, so when you get out of the train, you see right away the corner of Broadway and 80th Street, where Rabbi Soloveitchik used to give a shiur for many, many years in Maria, in Beis HaKnesses Maria. So I remember, when I finished college, I started going to the shiurim in Maria. I had time to go on Tuesday nights. So I remember Rabbi Soloveitchik, I think, dedicated 11 years to studying Gemara Brachas. 11 years. Most of the Gemara Brachas deals with Dinim Derabbanan. And after he finished Brachas, then he dedicated a few years to study Gemara Megillah, which is also mostly Dinim Derabbanan. So around the year number 15 or so, he mentioned in the middle of one of the shiurim, somebody may be wondering, why does he spend so much time studying Dinim Derabbanan, which on the level of the Reis is really Bittul Torah? Maybe he should have spent more time studying Zvachim and Menachos, which deals with Dinim Deraisa, so would have constituted the mitzvah of Talmud Torah on the level of Deraisa. Why did he only study Dinim Derabbanan, which are Talmud Torah mid Derabbanan, but on the level of Deraisa is Bittul Torah? Why not study Dinim Deraisa? So he said he doesn't think that that assumption is correct. He thinks that although the obligation to fulfill Dinim Derabbanan is obviously only mid Derabbanan, the obligation to observe the Dinim Derabbanan is not min HaTorah, but nonetheless, once the Chachamim instituted all the Dinim Derabbanan, they become a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh on the level of their Isa. And whoever studies them is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah on the level of their Isa. It's not just on the level of their Isa, it's really Bittul Torah. We're talking about Dvarim B'Teilim. We're talking about the stocks, or talking about sports or something. Midirabbanan, it constitutes Talmud Torah. He thought, no, once the Chachamim institute these Gzeris or these Takonis, these two become a chelik of Torah Shebal Peh on the level of their Isa. And the Rambam seems to be assuming like this explicitly. This Rambam, who breaks down all of Torah Shebal Peh into the five sections, and the fourth and the fifth sections are the Gzeiros and the Takonis, he seems pretty clearly to be assuming that all the Dinim Derabbanan are a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh on the level of their Raisa. Just to explain, how can such a thing exist? What do you mean the obligation to fulfill the mitzvahs Midirabbanan is only Midirabbanan? But nonetheless, when we study the Dinim, it constitutes a mitzvah of Talmud Torah on the level of their Isa. Isn't that double talk? How is one to understand that? So Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out a famous passage in the Gemara, which we'll have to speak about more at length, maybe next week or the week after, where the Gemara has a comment in Erevin on Daf Yud Gimel regarding the many disputes between the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel. Shammai and Hillel themselves lived 100 years before the destruction in the Second Temple, and each one established a big yeshiva. And during the days of Shammai and Hillel, there was only one dispute between them. And then as the years went on, there were many disputes, many disagreements between the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel, the yeshivas of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. So the Talmud has a comment regarding all of these disputes that really, Eilu v'yeilu divrei Elokim chayim. What does that mean? What does that mean? So the literal translation is that these and those, Rabbi Schwab wrote a book that's called These and Those, Eilu v'yeilu, because he has a machloikis about whether he should go to university or not. So he says, Eilu v'yeilu divrei Elokim chayim. They both have validity. Okay, so these and those are both the words of the living God. So what does that mean? We'll have to discuss it more at length later, but part of what it means is, what's relevant to this section of the talk, is that it doesn't mean you can do whatever you don't please. It doesn't mean like that. Dr. Belkin, who used to be the president of Yeshiva University for many years, always used to be very upset about that people thought you can paskin whatever you want. I said, that's ridiculous. There's only, in Shulchan Aruch, there's only one way to paskin. That's it, the way it says in Shulchan Aruch. It means in the yeshiva, when you come to a page in the Gemara, and you know in advance that they're going to be spending the next couple of pages discussing the opinions of Beis Shammai, I said, don't skip it. Don't think that that's Bittul Torah. When you study the opinion that's not accepted, la'alocha, that's not Bittul Torah. Because the views of Beis Shammai are also a chelik of Talmud Torah. To use the language of Rabbi Soloveitchik, he said that the opinions of Beis Shammai constitute a cheftza shel Torah. It is a text of Torah. When you study it, you're in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, despite the fact that there's no chayvus agavra. There's no obligation at all to follow Beis Shammai. Not only no obligation, you're not permitted to follow the opinions of Beis Shammai. Even b'shas hadchak, when sometimes we rely on an obscure opinion, so the poskim say you cannot rely on the Beis Shammai Shita even b'shas hadchak. We'll have to discuss that more later. So Rabbi Soloveitchik quoted this statement in the Talmud, Eilu v'yeilu divrei Elokim chayim, to demonstrate that such a concept exists. Something can constitute a cheftza shel Torah. It's considered a chelak of Torah shebal peh. And if you study the views of Beis Shammai, you want is clearly yotze the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. If I have, let's say, some nut wrote a book, Shadis HaTshuvas, and I know in advance that everything he wrote there is ridiculous. So when you read the book, he may get an A for effort, but everything he wrote is wrong. So when you read this book and you get a good laugh, that's not a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. If you know in advance that everything, if you're told in advance that everything in this book is wrong, there are many books like that in every library. There are many books that are ridiculous. Okay, so we have the scholars have, in every field, the scholars read books and they know who's a crank and who's a scholar, who knows what they're talking about. So there are certain sforim we know throughout all the generations that are ridiculous, that the people didn't know what they were talking about. So the fellow who thought that he was discovering America, okay, so he gets an A for effort. he tried to figure out the truth, so he fulfilled the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. But in later generations, once we know that that book is ridiculous, we don't get a mitzvah of Talmud Torah by reading something that we know in advance is wrong. But when we study the views of Beis Shammai, we don't say that they're wrong. We say we don't paskin like them. As far as halacha l'maaseh, we don't paskin like the Beis Shammai. But it doesn't mean that they're wrong. They were entitled to their opinion. They weren't wrong. And we say it constitutes a cheftz of Torah shebal peh. One who studies their opinion is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, even though there's no chayvus hagavra. So similarly, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say that when we study Gemara Brachas for 11 years, and then he studied Megillah for 5-6 years, it's not that on the level of the Raisa this is Bittul Torah and it's only a mitzvah of Talmud Torah midirabbanan. No, all the dinim derabbanan, once they were instituted, become a chelik of the Torah shebal peh, min haTorah. And one who studies these takanas derabbanan, the gzeres derabbanan, is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah on the level of the Raisa, despite the fact that the obligation to fulfill these mitzvahs from the Rabbanan is clearly not on the level of the Raisa. The Chavis HaGavra, the obligation of the individual to observe these Din and Rabbanan is only the Rabbanan. But nonetheless, it constitutes a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh on the level of the Raisa. Please. No, very often you can, very often you cannot. We're going to have to explain that. We're going to have to talk about that at length. We'll get to that a little later. Maybe next week or the week after. That's one of the main topics that I want to discuss. Now, based on this idea that the Rambam seems to have, that the Dinim de Rabbana, the Takonis and the Xeris de Rabbana become a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh, the women are only obligated to learn those parts of the halacha that are relevant to them. So the women are not obligated to learn the views of Beis Shammai. But if they do learn the views of Beis Shammai, it's like a woman, shakes a lulav. Okay, so she gets reward as an enem mitzvah, so like a woman who listens to Tkiyah Shofar. So although the women are not obligated to study the opinions of Beis Shammai and all the views that are not accepted, but if a woman will study that, so she'll get reward like an enem mitzvah. So that's correct. That's what you pointed out. Yeah, still constitutes a mitzvah of Talmud Torah, that's correct. All of the Dinim de Rabbanan become a part of the Torah Shebal Peh with respect to this mitzvah of Talmud Torah, that if a person on the level of their eyes, that's what it would appear. That's what it would appear, right? Now with this we can understand, with this premise we can understand why the Talmud has in many places, one place is in Psachim, Daf Lamed Ches on the base, but you look in the cross references, it's an expression that appears in the Talmud many times. The Gemara has a principle, when the rabbis are interested in instituting a Din de Rabbanan, either a Gzeir or a Takana, so the Gemara has an expression called the Tikkun Rabbanon Ke'ein De'araisa Tikkun. Whenever the rabbis make a takana, for that matter, a gzera, we'll explain what the difference is in a few minutes. They should make the gzeras, they should make all the dinam de Rabbanon patterned after the dinam de'araisa. Why? Because all of these dinam de Rabbanon are going to self-kosef, they're going to blend in to become a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh on the level of de'araisa. So if you want everything to fit into one big system, all of the Torah fits into one system. It's not you have one mitzvah of tefillin and one mitzvah of tzitzis, one mitzvah of krishma, they're unrelated. The premise of the halacha is that all the dinim blend in to constitute one gigantic mosaic, one big system, one big pattern. And that's why we have the right to learn at midin echad lachaveira, the Torah Shebal Peh. Part of the learning in between the lines, we're going to have to discuss how you do that. The midrash turn reshes pem. How did the rabbis figure out how to read in between the lines? So part of the story is that we assume a premise, a tradition has it, that all of the laws of the Torah blend into one big system. So if over here by tefillin there's a din, so it must be the same din in the other places as well. Take for example, everybody knows when you shake the lulav and the esrog, you have to hold the pitim up. If you hold the pitim down, there's no good. Where's the pasuk? The pasuk is by the mishkan, that it says atzei shitim omdim. There's no pasuk by the esrog. The pasuk is by the Mishkan. When they took the Atzi Shittim to construct the Mishkan, they had to have them kederach kedilosam. They had to have the boards that were from wood, from the trees, had to be standing in the upright position in the way they grew. They couldn't have the boards sideways. They couldn't have them sideways and couldn't have upside down. They had to be the way they grew from the ground. And the Gemara learns out from that pasuk that it's not a local din, even though the pasuk is only by the Mishkan. It applies to any mitzvah in the Torah where you require some natural object. Here, the Aron Kodesh doesn't have to be made from wood. The chairs in the shul don't have to be made from wood. They can be made from plastic. You don't have to have any chairs in the shul. You can sit on the floor. So there is no halacha over here that the benches have to be, the wood and the benches have to be kederach kedilosa. But if whenever there is a requirement to use some natural object, some vegetable, or something that grows from the ground for the purpose of a mitzvah, then it has to be held kederach kedilosa. And this is the principle, this is one of the major principles in reading in between the lines to develop the Torah Shebaal Peh. We assume all of Kol HaTorah Kulo in Yin Echod. That's how the Tosefta says in Sanhedrin. The Tosefta has the following din, it's in Shulchan Aruch. When the Rebbe would be giving a shiur, so the students had a right to ask a question from time to time. Can't ask before the Rebbe begins the shiur. In the middle of the shiur, the students had a right. They say that when Rabbi Soloveitchik visited Eretz Yisrael in 1935 to try out for the position in Tel Aviv, so they invited him to give shiurim all over in the different yeshivas. And it was a very exciting time because no one had met him before, and he was very young at that time, very forceful in the shiurim. So they say when he was in Petach Tikva, they invited him to say a shiur there by Rabbi Reuven Katz's yeshiva. So he started to say, the Gemara zokt. He started to say, the Gemara says, before he said what? So someone screamed out, Sadar Gemara Faket. They said, right, there's a Gemara that says Faket. It's certainly true. Whenever you have one Gemara, there's always a Gemara that says Faket. But before he even opened his mouth, he asked the question. So it's understood that when the Rebbe says a shiur, the students have a right to ask questions at certain intervals. If he says something and they don't understand, fine, they have a right to ask. So what if the student asks a question that has nothing to do with the topic? The Rebbe is giving a shiur on tzitzis, and all of a sudden the student asks the shaila in Hilchos Shabbos. So it says the Rebbe doesn't have to answer, because it's just disrupting the whole shiur, and the student has to apologize in public and say, Shaloi ki inyan shalti, I apologized, I had no right to ask the question. And then that's the accepted opinion. Then Tosefta quotes the opinion of Reb Meir, who says, you never have to apologize because kol HaTorah Kulo inyan echod. Everything is interconnected. Whatever idiotic question this guy asked, in some indirect way, it certainly has a connection with the shiur. So we don't accept his opinion that the student doesn't have to apologize. The psak in Shulchan Aruch is that he does have to apologize and say publicly, Shaloi ki inyan sha'alti, but the premise that Rameir said is an accepted premise. That's not disputed. That kol ha-Torah kula inyan echad. We assume that all the laws of the Torah blend in to make one big pattern, one big mosaic. And that's why we derive din in midin echad lahaver. That's a big chunk of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Reading in between the lines is that we try to figure out what's the system, what's the pattern, what are the underlying themes that are shared in common by all of the mitzvahs? So the dinim derabbanan are patterned after the dinim deraisa also, because we assume that the dinim derabbanan are going to be blending in to become a chelik of the Torah Shebaal Peh on the level of deraisa. In fact, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was a great tzaddik who was killed by the Nazis, he was a student of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, he had his own yeshiva in Baranovich. There are many of the famous rabbanim today are students of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has a sefer on Yevamos, a famous sefer that's called Koivitz Haaretz. It's available in all the stores. All the men who study in Yeshivas Yevamos all use this sefer. A collection of comments. That's what it's called. He was so humble, didn't want to call it a sefer, that he has essays to say. He said, a collection of comments. Koivitz, a collection of Haaretz. It's not a collection of comments. It's major essays, not just on Yevamos, it's on all of Torah. So he has two essays in the collection of essays, in the Koivitz Haaretz on Yevamos, where he gives you many examples from the Talmud where people wouldn't realize it, where they have dinim derabbanan that are patterned after dinim deraisa, that we really wouldn't know what the din deraisa is if not for the din derabbanan. After the Amoraim saw Mishnayos that was speaking about dinim derabbanan, and the Amoraim understood what was in the back of the minds of the Tanoim based on the way they made a din derabbanan. If the Tana made a din derabbanan like this, it must be that he thought there was a din deraisa like that. It has to be patterned after some din deraisa. Rabbi Soloveitchik also in his shiurim used to bring out many examples of this principle. from the Dinim Derabbanan and the Mishnais and in the Talmud, we can sometimes discern, we can sometimes figure out what the Dinim Deraisa were. Because if there was no such Din Deraisa, where did they invent Yesh Me'ayin, a Din Derabbanan? Must be patterned after some kind of a Din Deraisa or another. So this is one principle, that because called the Tikkun Rabbanan came Deraisa Tikkun, because all the Dinim Derabbanan become a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh, and Min HaTorah, that's why the rabbis, when instituting a Din Derabbanan, were careful to pattern all the Dinim Derabbanan in the style of the Dinim Deraisa. Didn't just make a Din Derabbanan unrelated to anything. Another important idea based on this principle is the notion that's developed by the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch that's called the Taz, the Terizov. Terizov lived in the 1660s in Poland. And he was the son-in-law of the Bach. The Bach, Bais Chodesh, is a commentary on the side of the Torah. How the story, the way famous story, the way he proposed to the Bach's daughter. He said, "Shein bi d'levana." Bach said about his daughter, in the middle of a whole discussion, "Shein bi d'levana." So the Taz says, "Shein seiten karizayin d'levana." So he married her. The whole story. So the Taz quotes this famous kasha from his father-in-law, from the Bach. The rabbis made a gzeira d'rabbanan on that you're not permitted to blow shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, because we are afraid that somebody may forget and carry the shofar to shul. And it's more important, the avera of carrying the shofar, carrying on Shabbos is such a big avera, being mechal Shabbos is so terrible, it's much more important than having all of the Jews blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Okay, we'll have to discuss this a little later. So the Bach has this famous kasha. Why did the rabbis only prohibit blowing shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos? Because they're concerned somebody may forget and carry on Shabbos in the street. They should have done away with Kiyah Shofar, period, every Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because we have a gzeira in the Mishnayos that you're not permitted to play any musical instruments on Shabbos. You're not allowed to play a piano, even if it's not with any electricity. To play a piano or to play a flute is prohibited on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Even in Chol HaMoed there's a dispute. We pass Ken Mutar. But on Shabbos and Yom Tov, it's prohibited to play any musical instrument. Gzeira Shemi Yisakin Kli Shir. If the person will get so involved in the music, he'll get so engrossed, he'll forget. And he'll hear the piano's off key, he may fix the piano. It's a question. Our piano is not so easy to fix. So maybe the Gzeira shouldn't apply to our piano. That's a further discussion. But that's what it says in the Mishnah, that you're not permitted to play musical instruments on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Gzeira Shemi Yisakin Kli Shir. The person may get so carried away with the music, he'll forget that it's Shabbos and he may fix the instrument. So blowing a shofar is also a musical instrument. It's also used to be mashmiya kol. So the rabbi should have done away totally with the whole tkiya shofar. Forget about Rosh Hashanah shecholiyos b'shabbos. Every Rosh Hashanah is a yontif. And you're not allowed to play any musical instruments, especially the way the Ramah and Shulchan Aruch paskins that you're not allowed to use a door knocker either. That was a big dispute in Europe. In Germany, they used to use knockers on Shabbos. Because a knocker is not a klishir, it's not a musical instrument. It's an instrument like a grogger, it doesn't make music, it just makes a racket, makes noise. So the Ramah prohibits that too. The Ramah says that not only the Ramah lived in Poland, so his psak was not accepted in Germany, but this psak. But the Ramah in Poland writes that not only are you not allowed to play a musical instrument, you're not allowed to use any kli hamiyuchad lahashmas kol. So a shofar, number one, is really a musical instrument. Number two, even if people today don't use it as a musical instrument, it's clearly an instrument that's like a graga, like a knocker. It's miyuchad to be mashmiya kol. It's used to make noise, to make a racket. So why doesn't it fall under the prohibition of mashmiya kol? You shouldn't be allowed to blow shofar at all, period, on any Rosh Hashanah. This is the kasha that the Bach asked. So the Taz, the son-in-law, in his commentary on Hilchos, the Taz is printed on the side of the page in all the standard editions of the Shulchan Aruch, regular editions of the Shulchan Aruch. So the Terizov, that's called the Taz, or Rashi Tevis Terizov, writes in the name of the Bach that the answer is that when the rabbis made the Gzeiros Derabbanan, they had no right to undo a mitzvah in a Torah totally. They're going to undo the whole mitzvah of Tkiya Shofar, but it says in the Chumash you have to blow Shofar. They can't make a Gzeiros Derabbanan uprooting the whole pasuk in the Chumash. In the Chumash it says you blow Shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It doesn't say explicitly that you even blow Shofar even when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos. It's self-understood. Why shouldn't you blow Shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos? What's the difference? Whether Rosh Hashanah is Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Friday, or Shabbos. On the level of the rice, it doesn't make a difference. But since it doesn't say explicitly that you blow Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, even if it falls out on Shabbos, so the rabbis had the authority to prohibit that. They forbade blowing Shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos because they're afraid someone's going to forget and carry. But to make a gzeira d'rabbanan to do away totally with the mitzvah of tkiyah shofar, that's against the pasuk in Chumash. He says that they had no authority to do. And this theme he repeats in another two places in his commentary, one in Yeridei and one in Chayshim Mishpat. This is a popular theme among Achreinim and among Rishonim. It wasn't first developed in the 1600s. It already appears in Tosfos in a few places in the commentary on the Talmud. And the reason behind this is, as we explained before, the Dinim D'Rabbanan, once they're instituted by the rabbis, blend in to become a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh. How can you have a Torah Shebal Peh becoming part of the body of the Torah with two things that contradict each other? The Chumash says you have to blow shofar, and the rabbis just prohibit all tkiyah shofar. They just yanked that, they ripped out the whole mitzvah. It's impossible. There's an outright contradiction. So the rabbis, the Taz, developed such a notion, and many poskim, Rishonim and Acharonim, hold like this. When the rabbis want to make a din d'rabbanan, they cannot institute a din d'rabbanan that's in clear contradiction, 100% contradiction to what it says in the Torah. They have to develop the din d'rabbanan somehow in such a way that it's not an open contradiction. Like, don't blow shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls on a Shabbat. That's not explicitly in contradiction to the Chumash. But to do away with the whole tkiyah shofar, that they can't do. It's interesting that Taz, when he develops this notion, quotes a passage from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin quotes a Braisa. A Braisa means a source from the period of the Tanoim. A Mishnah, the Mishnayos, were edited by Rabbi Yudah Nasi. He was the end of the period of the Tanoim. And he chose those traditions that were that he felt belonged into this official text of the Torah Shebal Peh. And he canonized, so to speak, the Mishnah. He took certain sections of the Torah Shebal Peh and included in the Mishnah. But then you have many old sources of Torah Shebal Peh, many Braises, that were never included in the Mishnah. Many of them are just elaborations of dinim in the Mishnah, but sometimes you have many brises add additional halachas. So the Talmud and Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Afmin Vavim and Aleph, quotes a very old brisa, very, very old brisa from the Megillas Tainus. Megillas Tainus is known as Megillas Tainus. Megillas Tainus is a book that was written by the Tanoim, and it was written taka, not just transmitted orally. It was written by the Tanoim at a time that it was still prohibited to write down the Torah Shebal Peh. This was written down, and it starts Nisan Iyar Sivan, goes in the order of the Jewish calendar, and lists off every day in the calendar that was instituted by the rabbis during the period of the Second Temple as a holiday, on which you're not allowed to have a tainus. You're not allowed to say hesped. If there's a levaya, rachman al-Islam, you're not allowed to say a hesped, and you're not allowed to have tainus. That's called Megillas Tainus. And the reason why it's called Megillas, Rashi writes, the reason why it's called Megillas Tainus is because this was written down at the time that the Mishnayos was not written down. This was written down before the days of the Mishnayos. It's just a question among the scholars which book was written down first, the Pirkei d'Rav Lezer or the Megillas Tainus, but they were both written down before the Mishnayos. The Mishnayos were written down way later. We're going to have to discuss that either next week or the week after. Exactly when were the Mishnayos written down, and what's the difference? Is it just a question of history, or does it have halachic ramifications, which it probably does? The answer is the second. It does have halachic ramifications. We'll have to explain what they are. But there were two books of the Torah Shebal Peh that were written down before the Mishnayos, before the Heter. This was at the time that it was prohibited to write down Torah Shebal Peh. So the first book, either one or the other, the first two that were written were the Megillas Tainus and the Pirkei d'Rav Lezer, and it's a question among the scholars which one was written first. Anyway, this Megillas Tainus, one of the oldest written sources of the Torah Shebal Peh, hardly has any halachas in it. That's why they permitted it to be written down. It just lists off the Yomim Tovim in there. Doesn't list the Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, that we all know. List off the additional holidays that were instituted during Bar Sheni, and what were they all about? What was the historical background? Like Chanukah and Purim are part of the Megillas Tainus. Those were additional during the period of the Second Temple. All of those Yom Tovim, one is Batlu. In the year 70, when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, the rabbis said, we don't celebrate anything anymore, and then we have to observe Avelus over the destruction of the temple. There's nothing to rejoice about. All those holidays have to do with the building of the temple, or the improvement of the sacrifices, or the improvement of the building, or the different functions of the Beis HaMikdash. And once the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, so there's nothing to celebrate about. So after the Churban HaBayis, they said, no more celebration of the Yomim Tovim. Now it's time to observe Avelus. And the only two holidays that remain from the whole book of the Megillas Tainus, it's a little book, used to sell for $1 years ago, skinny little book. Now it sells for $3, a thin little book. So the only two holidays that remain from the whole Megillas Tainus are Chanukah and Purim. So it hardly has any halachas there. One of the handful of halachas that appears in the Megillas Tainus is this passage that's quoted by the Gemara in Sanhedrin. We have a tradition, that the Bezin has a right, Beis Din has a right to give the death penalty to a person who doesn't really deserve a death penalty. Or the Beis Din has a right to give malchus to a person who doesn't really deserve malchus. And the examples that are given are, one example that's given is, a person was caught riding a horse on Shabbos in public. I mean, riding a horse is only prohibited by the Rabbanan. It's not a biblical violation. So you can't get the death penalty for being Mechal Shabbos on the level of the Rabbanan. The punishment of death, Oinish Misa, Skila, for Mechal Shabbos, is only if the person violated a biblical prohibition. You don't get the death penalty for the Rabbanan. But at that time, the rabbis were afraid that if this fellow will get away with it, then everybody in the community will start riding their horses. So they felt compelled to do something, so they felt it's absolutely necessary to give them the death penalty, which they did. So they violated Loi Sirtzach. And the Gemara says that tradition has it that it's permissible. If it's Loi Roa, sure, they can't say throughout all the generations, whenever anybody does an Aver de Rabbanim, we give a death penalty. That's in violation to the laws of the Torah. But if it's only Loi Roa, sure, the Migda Milsa, it's only of a temporary nature, and they want to prevent a big pirtza in religious observance, then they're permitted to do it. So the expression, Talmud has another, a few examples there. So the expression used by the Bryce in the Megillah Steinis is that the rabbis are doing this below la avor al divrei Torah, not that they want to violate the laws of the Torah, ella, but rather kedei lasos siog la Torah. The thing that prompts the rabbis to give the death penalty lohai roshah is in order to strengthen the laws of the Torah. It's a very striking expression. Below la avor al divrei Torah, what prompts the rabbis to do such a strange thing, to give a death penalty when it doesn't, when it's not required, when it's not permitted, or to give malchus when it's not in accordance with halacha, is below la avor al divrei Torah, not to violate the laws of the Torah, but rather to strengthen the laws of the Torah. Of course, it's to strengthen. What do the rabbis want to violate the laws of the Torah? The expression that's used in the Brice and Megillah's Tainus doesn't make any sense. The rabbis are not doing it to violate the laws of the Torah. It doesn't make any sense. So the Taz, the Turizov, in his commentary on Hilchas Rosh Hashanah says, no, that's what it means. When the rabbis want to make a din de Rabbanon, they cannot make a din de Rabbanon that's in outright contradiction to a biblical law. Because the din of the Rabbanon are going to have to blend in to become a chelik of the Torah Shebal Peh. So they can't have something in the Torah Shebal Peh that's outright in contradiction to the Torah Shebichsav. So they have to formulate in such a way, it shouldn't be lavar al divrei Torah. It's not talking about what motivates the rabbis. Of course the motivation is not lavar al divrei Torah. We're talking about the formulation of the din de Rabbanon. The din de Rabbanon has to be formulated in such a way that it shouldn't be an outright contradiction to the din HaTorah. It's interesting that this comment that was made by the Taz in his commentary on his Brice of lavar al divrei Torah was made by another one of the Gedolim, the Maharam Lublin, who was around the same time, in his tshuvas. He has a famous tshuvas in the Kufla Metches. A good part of the tshuva was left out in a later edition. So years ago, Professor Lewin, Zechon Lerocha, who taught at the yeshiva, published this from earlier editions of manuscripts. It's a very interesting history. Years ago, the publishers used to edit the svara whenever there was a tshuva that they thought was risky, so they just left it out. They left it out. They would change the text. This is wild stuff. So Professor Lewin reprinted this tshuva of the Maharam Lublin the way it originally appeared. And it's a very fascinating tshuva. Very fascinating tshuva. So part of this tshuva, he brings out the same idea that the Turezo brought out on this expression in the Braisa, that when it says in the Begilas Tainis, the Talmud is not speaking about what motivates the rabbis to give the Niso, the Malkus, Lohai Roshah, but rather is talking about the nature of the din de Rabbanon. The din de Rabbanon cannot be an outright contradiction to a din de Raisa. Now here, this Brice in Megillas Tainis is not really talking about dinim de Rabbanon. It's not talking about Xeris or Takonis that are going to be of a lasting nature to last for a couple of centuries. The Brice is talking about Mak Miyanshin Shalom and Adin. The Brice is talking about the Beis Din giving Malkus Amisa just on one occasion as a Hayro Ashoa. A din de Rabbanon as a Hayro Ashoa. So it's interesting, even a din de Rabbanon la Hayro Ashoa, also, the Beis Din has to be careful, lo lav al divrei Torah, not to make a hayro ashoa that's an outright contradiction to the dinim of the Torah. This idea that even a hayro ashoa cannot be made an outright contradiction, a hayro ashoa also apparently is supposed to blend in to be part of the Torah. Not only all the dinim derabbanan that are of a lasting nature, that are supposed to last for centuries, even a hayro ashoa also becomes part of the Torah Shebal Peh. That's what it appears. And you cannot formulate a hayro ashoa in such a fashion that it's an outright contradiction to the Din HaTorah. this idea is not something that's floating in the air. This is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, Halacha Lamaisa, in the Choshen Mishpat, from the very beginning, one of the early Simon, I think it's Simon Gimel, in the Choshen Mishpat, where the Shulchan Aruch discusses this topic. Bez Makamiyan Shin Shloimen Adin. It says that the every community has a Shiva Tulihuir. They have a board of directors, 7-member board of directors, Shiva Tulihuir, or whatever else they have. So it says the local board of directors of the community has a right to punish people, perhaps a penalty of mammon, or even a penalty of death, sometimes a malchus, if they feel that it's necessary, with the approval of the rabbinate and so on. And it says in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramo and Chosh Mishpat quotes from the Tshuvas HaGoinim, that whenever you have this principle applied, Makam Yonshin Shalom and Adin, the Bezna has a right to punish in money, or to give a bodily punishment of Misa or Malkus, they have to be careful that it shouldn't be an outright contradiction to the laws of the Torah. So to give the following mashal, the Ramo quotes from the Tshuvas HaGoinim. The Ramo quotes the following from the Tshuvas HaGoinim. Let's say a person violated an Avera, which it says in the Torah that he has to pay 50 shkolim. There are certain examples. It says you pay 50 shkolim, 100 shkolim. And this is a knas. And we have a principle that because today nobody has any smicha, so we cannot put together a bezin to make somebody pay a knas. So the fellow's going to get away with this criminal is going to get away with everything. So Shulchan Aruch, they quote from the Gaon, you don't let him get away. The bezin should give a hayrosh, or they should punish him. But they shouldn't punish him with the exact same amount of money that it says in the Torah, 50 shkolim. They should either punish him to pay more or less. If you make him a punishment to pay exactly the same amount that it says in the Torah, but we don't have any smicha today, so then we're outright in violation of the laws of the Torah. It says you need a bezin of smuchim, you need real smuchim, to give a penalty of a knas. We don't have any smicha today, so we cannot administer the penalty of knas. If we want to make a hayrosh shor, we have to be careful that the hayrosh shor isn't the same as what it says in the Chumash. Then we're outright in violation of the Torah. The Torah says you can only make this knas if you have smicha. So we who don't have smicha have to give either a knas, either more or less. Either we make him pay 40 shkolim or 100 shkolim. Something different from what it says in the Torah, not to be an outright violation of what it says in the Chumash. Right, he wasn't right. They couldn't have warned him. Normally, to give a death penalty.
How is this possible? How can you be something be done to you that isn't part of law? All right, he was going to get on that
law. Right, under normal circumstances, in order to give anybody the death penalty or malchus, you have to have hasra. He has to be warned in advance. This fella clearly was not warned. They just warned him, don't do it. So that's lahira shah. The bezin has a right to give the death penalty, even if they choose to on a. Just on one instance, not to. They can't pass a law that from now on we're going to give the death penalty without any hasra. That they can't do. They're changing the laws of the Torah.
What can they do to that one man?
That's a tradition that we have, that the bezin has a right to violate the laws of the Torah. Lahayra shor lamigda milsa. If they feel that they're going to accomplish something great, we're going to have to discuss. That's what the reform movement said. That's what the conservative rabbi said. We should encourage the balabatim to drive to the synagogue on Sabbath in order to maintain Jewish identity. If they're not going to have a drive to the synagogue on Sabbath, they're going to stay and watch television all day long and they'll become goyim gemara. So what's the difference between that and the Talmud? So we have to discuss that. That's an important topic. Yeah, certainly, yeah. That's the reason why they give this hayrasha. They don't have to have smicha, right? They don't even have to be Torah scholars. It says the 7 members of the board can give the death penalty. The Zayin Tuvi Huir. They don't even have to have smicha. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. No, for real. Actually happened. For real. Actually happened. In fact, there's a famous story that's told in the Talmud. We know that there are 4 forms of the death penalty. There's Skila, Sreifa, Sayif, and Chenik. And Sreifa doesn't mean that you burn the person at the stake. You don't burn him to death. Sreifa means that you open up the person's mouth and you pour down melted lead and you burn out the kishkis inside. And the reason why we give this form of death penalty, the Torah says Sreifa, so why don't you just burn him? So the Gemara says, no, it says, V'yahavta l'reacha kamoicha. You have to bror lo misa yofa. You have to give him a pleasant form of sreifa. So that's considered, one is considered much more unpleasant than the other. So we give him the pleasant form of death penalty where we pour the melted lead down the fellow's throat. Okay, that's a Mishnah. So the Talmud records a story. One of the Amoroim, they were Tanoim, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed around the year 70. And the Talmud has a tradition that 40 years before the destruction of the Second Temple, the Sanhedrin left their official offices, their location on the Lishkas Hagozes, and they went into Golos. And what's the halachic significance? That from that time on, from the year 30 on, 40 years before the year 70, no bezin anywhere in the world can be dandid in the Foshas anymore. No bezin can be dandid in the Foshas unless you have the Sanhedrin located in their official office in the Lishkas Hagozes. Most of the Tanoim lived after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Amoroim lived after the Tanoim. So the Talmud tells a story. One of the Amoroim who lived in Bavel, one day, a person did an avera for which he deserved, happened to be a woman. So the woman deserved the death penalty of Sreifa. One of the people of Sreifa is Abbas Kohen Shezinsu. Okay, Sreifa Sreifa. So she deserved the death penalty of Sreifa. So this Amora made a big fire and she burnt it to death. The Gemara says he just made two little mistakes. He made one mistake, that that's not the correct form of giving Sreifa. Sreifa is supposed to pour the molten lead down the throat. The other little mistake was that from the year 30 on, this fellow lived a few centuries later. He lived in the period of the Amoraim, which is after the Tanoim, which is after the destruction of the Temple, which is after the Sanhedrin went into Golus. He forgot that we don't administer Din in the Foshes Bizman Hazeh. So the Gemara says he made two mistakes. So one of the commentaries on the Gemara, in the back of the Gemara you have the Maharshal, is printed, the commentary of the Maharshal. So he says he would suggest that maybe he didn't make any mistakes. He says, I'm not disagreeing with the Gemara on a halachic issue. He's disagreeing on history. He says he thinks he has the right to disagree with the Gemara on history. He thinks that maybe the one mistake, the one kasha for him is the other. He wanted to give the death penalty lahayru ashor lemigda milsa, and it says in Shulchan Aruch that you're allowed to do that. Makam yonchin shalom, and you can even give the death penalty when it's not warranted. But he didn't want to give sreifa the way it's supposed to be, because that would be an outright violation of the law. Like we said, it says in Choshen Mishpat, when the bezin wants to penalize somebody, give him a knas, a penalty. So they can't penalize him the exact same amount of money that it says in the Torah you should punish him the 50 shkolim. No, we don't have any smicha today. So we can't do that, so we have to go round about. You have to either penalize him 40 or 60 or 100 or something. Some different amount that we shouldn't be in outright contradiction to the laws of the Torah. So the Maharshal in his commentary in the back of the Gemara suggests maybe the one kasha for him is the other. Maybe the Eneni Kecholik ala Gemara, he says, I'm not disagreeing with the Talmud. He says he just thinks that historically he can answer this kasha. He says he's not disagreeing halachically. Historically he thinks he has the right to disagree. And he says maybe because he knew that he wasn't allowed to administer Einish Misa of Bizman Shein Sanhedrin Yeshvim Bim Kaimam, so that's why he Bidavke chose to give a different form of the Sreifa, not to give the traditional halachic form. Just parenthetically, this is a big topic for discussion in halachic literature. Do we have a right to disagree with the Talmud on historical issues? Is that so? We have a commentary by the Vilna Gaon that was written by the students. Most of the things from the Vilna Gaon were written by students and were not written by him. So some of the students heard straight and some of them didn't hear straight. You have all kinds of contradictions of things in the name of the Vilna Gaon. So in the commentary on Mishnayis Brochas, the Aderes Eliyahu, the commentary written by the students in the name of the Vilna Gaon on Mishnayis Brochas, they comment on the Mishnah in Brochas that says, Tfilas, we daven Shachris Mincha Mairev every day. So it says, Mairev, Tfilas Arvis, Ein Lo Keva. Ein lo keva. What does that mean? So the Talmud says what it means is that shachris and mincha is a takana that you require to daven shachris and mincha, and ma'ariv is what we call rishus. It's not as serious an obligation as shachris and mincha. If you have some great pressing needs, so you can forgo davening mark. Krishma, you have to say, but you can forgo davening mark. Okay. Whereas if a person's very tired and they already put on his pajamas and he's half asleep, so they don't have to wake him up to say ma'ariv, you can let him sleep because tefillah service is only rishus. So the Talmud says that that's what it means in the Mishnah. That tefillah service ain't lo keva. It's not a chok kavua. It's not really absolutely required by the Chacham. It was instituted as a rishus. So they quote in the name of the Vilna Gaon that he gave a different translation of the Mishnah. He says it's not disagreeing la halacha with what it says in the Talmud. He's just interpreting the Mishnah differently. So there's a big discussion in later Svarim whether this was really said by the Vilna Gaon or not. We mentioned last week there was Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein was the one who put together the Torah Tmimo, the popular Chumash that people use. We have the comments from the Talmud quoted in every passage from the Chumash. Many people use the Torah Tmimo. So he wrote the famous autobiography. that's called the Mekor Baruch. And his autobiography has much less than 50% is autobiography. And the bulk of his Mekor Baruch, three fat volumes, the bulk of his autobiography, he talks in learning. He was a banker by profession, but he knew how to learn very nicely. And he has a lot of comments on Torah. One section he has about this, he wonders whether this, he's a very modern thinker. He lived in America for a period of time. His father was the Aruch HaShulchan. He lived in America in the 1930s, I think. Must have died 1940s or something. Maybe 1950s, I'm not sure myself. So he writes he's not so convinced that this is an accurate quotation from the Vilna Gaon. He doesn't think that the students got it straight. So this is a famous discussion, whether do we have the right to disagree with the historical tradition that the Talmud gives us if it's not relevant halacha l'maaseh. We're not disagreeing with the Talmud in halacha, we're just disagreeing in history. So is there anything wrong with that? Okay, that's just as a side topic. So just getting back again, just to sum up what we were discussing now, we started last week with the Hakdamas HaRambam, the Pirush HaMishnayis, where he divides all of Torah Shebaal Peh into five sections. And the last two sections of the Torah Shebaal Peh are the Dinim Derabbanan. He considers all the Dinim Derabbanan as a chelik of the Torah Shebaal Peh. And he speaks about the two, the fourth and the fifth sections are the Gzeris and the Takonas. Now we have to explain what is a Gzeris, what is a Takonah, and what is the source for this? How do we know that the rabbis have the right to institute Gzeris? And to what extent did they have the right to institute Gzeris? And what is the source from the Chumash that they have a right to institute Takonas? So believe that next week we'll have to continue. Pardon me? The Talmud says that the Mishnayos were all checked out by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and we assume that those are all authoritative. The Brises, the Talmud says you can never tell which Brises is reliable and which Brises is not reliable. Some Brises may not be accurate. The Talmud says that there were a set of Brises that were edited by Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Oshio, so we know that those are accurate. But other Brises may not necessarily be accurate. Yeah, the Gemara will always use it. Sometimes they'll say it's not accurate. Most of the time they'll say they'll assume it is accurate. There's another book by Rabbi Hanan Wasserman that we'll be quoting from next week and the following weeks that's called Puntras Divrei Sofer. It's about the relationship between Divrei Torah and Divrei Sofer. This is very famous. Yes.
I said just very briefly, you know, there was somebody who said that the community of Jews in Galut is not like the real community of Jews in Eretz Yisrael.
That's the did. That's not somebody said. The Gemara said that.
What exactly was it?
Thank
you very much.
And next week and the weeks after, we'll be using this one. Also by the same author, Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, but he speaks about the relationship between Divrei Torah and Divrei Sofer. He speaks a lot about it. The Talmud says that whenever there's a din that applies to Klal Yisrael, the definition of Klal Yisrael is the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. Those who live in Chutz Lords are also second-rate citizens. They're also, like Ben-Gurion said, the Jews who live in Chutz Lords are not Jewish. That's not it.